Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. In this episode, I talk with Nicholas Benish, the founder of the Board Director Training Institute of Japan. Nick has a background in both law and business. He has a JD MBA from UCLA and a BA in political science from Stanford University. He is bilingual in Japanese and English and has served on a number of boards in Japan, 13 years in total. He gained broad experience in investment banking during 11 years at JP Morgan in New York, London, and Tokyo, after which he founded his boutique M&A advisory firm in Tokyo. Nick is one of the leading corporate governance experts in Japan and has been active in policy advocacy in the region. We focus this discussion on the evolution of corporate governance in Japan, including his role in promoting the new corporate governance code and other general topics such as executive compensation, ESG, dual-class share structures, and his recent proposal to redesign incentives in corporations by creating an externalization or bankruptcy trust fund or ESG dividend fund. This proposal has been published and is available at the Harvard Law School Forum on Corporate Governance blog. If you like the show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast with colleagues or friends. You can also subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com. Hi, Nicholas. How are you doing? It is an incredible pleasure to have you in this podcast. I don't know if you recall, but we met, I actually looked at my notes in January of 2013 in Tokyo when I was back at Stanford running some of our executive education programs for directors. But it's great to talk to you again. How are you doing?
I'm fine, and it's great to be here. I do remember the meeting, as a matter of fact. I think it was in our small office in Yoga. So we meet again after 7 years.
It took me a while to find it. I had to go in a metro, and it was kind of complicated, but I made it.
I remember it.
So first question, by the way, how are you doing in COVID-19? I mean, the reports we get here is that Japan has dealt pretty well with it, but I'm curious, what's the current state in Tokyo or Japan with coronavirus?
The curve kind of replicates Korea with a 1 month or so, one and a half month lag, which is, they've done a very good job of flattening it at first. And then it's still such low numbers that it pales by comparison to the United States, but it's blipped back up as people, just like in the U.S., got a little bit too calm, too unworried, lost their anxiety, and they went out a small number of people went out in the town. So you have these blips up in both Korea and Japan now because of nightlife, entertainment, largely.
Yeah. So in the structure of this podcast, I'm very excited about this discussion. You have a very deep background in governance in Japan, so it's going to be really interesting to go through your general background and then talk about all these different topics that are both relevant to Japan and global governance, including the U.S. So I think that's great. But let's go back to your origin story and tell us where you grew up, and let's start from the early days.
Okay. I grew up in New Jersey. I'm Czech American. My father immigrated here during the war, and the other half of my family is Russian Jew from Russian Polish border. I grew up in rural or semi-rural slash sort of the borderline suburbs and country in New Jersey. It was a wonderful existence. I then went to Stanford for college, but only on the West Coast, I got the Asia bug, and particularly the Japan bug, reading books like, Herman Kahn's The Japanese Miracle and this kind of stuff. Japan was just emerging at that point in time. Mm-hmm. It's what China was 25 years ago, 20 years ago, 9%, 10% more yearly annual growth. And I was fascinated by what secret Japan had, but to be the first non-white, non-European-based country to industrialize so quickly and have such a fast growth rate. So I felt compelled to go see the country, not just study economic history with all these grad students. So my sophomore year, I came to Japan. That's my background then. And then I graduated, went to Hokkaido, was an English teacher, started an English school. And then I applied to law school because I got bored being an English teacher. Mm-hmm. And when I was at UCLA at law school, I lost interest in the law after my first clerkship here in Tokyo at a law firm. I discovered how boring being a lawyer would be, forgive me, and applied to the business school, so took a joint JD MBA degree. And after that, worked for 11 years as an investment banker, doing everything from soup to nuts at JP Morgan when it was in the midst of morphing itself into an investment bank. So that was very fun and active, shall we say. And every 2 years, I'd have a different job role. Every 1.5 years, basically.
And this was not only in Japan, or all of it in Japan?
This was in New York, derivatives, and then Japan, and then London, and then back to Japan. And when I left, I was the head of financial institutions, which is basically 80% of Morgan's profitability at that time. But I did all those other large real estate transactions and M&A transactions, which were good fun. And I left because I got kind of bored at Morgan for, all we really did then was mainly focus on the top 200 companies in Japan, if that, 150 companies, the big issuer clients, who give you big derivative trades as well, and bond underwriting deals, that kind of stuff. So I wanted to, look at the middle market more in Japan and help start up a M&A/risk management software boutique called Kamakura. And it turned out that after five years or so, the only people making money in the group were my group of three people doing M&A, and 22 other people were losing all the money. So I had to hit these big M&A sort of home runs to bail out the company twice. And we started up then our own boutique called JTP. Mm-hmm. I did that for 10 years. And in the meetings of that, I sat on various boards. So at this point, I'm going on my 13th year of sitting on a Japanese board, one form or another, that's not my own, or the American Chamber or something else that's nonprofit. So that's my experience in governance is actual experience on boards. But in Japan, I've never sat on a U.S. board, for instance, so I can't speak to that.
Why don't you tell us, how did you get into your first board in Japan? And obviously, in those years, a lot has happened, and we're going to go through the details on the evolution of governance in Japan. But tell us how it started and how you got into your first board, and how did that emerge or evolve into the next boards?
I was also interested in governance. I had been on a big research project when I was at UCLA on behalf of William Ochi, who was at Stanford before and then went to UCLA Business School, the guy who wrote Theory Z, which was one of the big books that sort of exploded the Japanese miracle of management. What's mm-hmm. Japanese management? What should we copy? And he was sort of my mentor. So I'd always been interested in organizations, management, and governance in that intersection, because, when you go to law school, you learn about these kind of things. So in 1998 or 9, my boutique did this is three people at that point in a boutique M&A operation. We did a deal for a company called MapInfo, a U.S. deal, where they bought 25% of Japan's third largest map company. So MapInfo is a map software company that needed data for its map software analysis tools. And Alps Mapping had all that data. And it was in digital form, but they were making printed books out of it. So MapInfo took a 25% position, and then they asked me to be on the board as their representative. But really, it was an independent board position because they didn't monitor what I did much. They really wanted just someone just watching the kitchen fires, make sure that the house didn't burn down, at least at first. It got a lot stickier later on. And I was on that board for almost 5 years. And as a matter of fact, ended up, if you can believe this, firing the son of the founder, who admitted he really wasn't sort of cut out to be the tasks. That's how I got him to step down. And putting in another guy who, since it was such a very difficult company to manage, I therefore had to get rid of later on because his performance wasn't very good either. And finally, the company went bankrupt. So my first board experience was a company that I could not, what I learned from it. I could not convince the board, a lot of other engineers who are good at making maps, that we got to sell this company to an internet-based firm that has a network on the internet to use the maps the way Google does or Yahoo Japan does and these kind of things in the digital universe, because otherwise we will be you know, the year by year that we don't hook up with somebody like that, the value of our digital map database is declining. I couldn't convince the board to sell itself, to sell the company until it was too late. And then I just banged at that door for literally 3 years, and at one point dragged in Yahoo Japan 2 years before we went under, and they refused. They only wanted to associate with or talk with PE firms. It would help them retain their managerial independence, they thought. And I would say, oh, you're smoking dope. You're crazy. If you think the M&A firm or the PE firms like JAFCO or whoever it was, Bain Capital, if you think they're going to help you be independent as managers and do what you want for more than 2 years to 3 years, you're crazy. They buy you in order to sell you downstream to someone else as fast as they possibly can. So if you want to control your future, you decide who it is that's going to be a better parent for you. And that's probably Yahoo Japan or somebody like that, who has more reason to invest long-term in you. But they couldn't accept that back then. And very much this is still in Japanese mentality, that selling out to a rival or someone you might possibly compete to is surrender. People hate surrender here. And selling to private equity that makes this nice, very pleasing, wooing pitch to managers that we're going to let you keep your present position appeals to them much more than it should.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So I learned that strategy the hard way, because in the end, the son of the founder had his guarantee on $20 million of loans to the company. And he had forgotten that his chop was still on guaranteeing the loans even after he stepped down from the position as CEO some 3 or 4 years earlier. He simply had forgotten that. This is how common it is for a CEO to guarantee debts of the company in Japan. But it put him under personal bankruptcy, and he had to work extremely low wages, getting, you know, half his wages docked to go to the bank for the next 10 years or so. It's really sad.
Wow, what a story. And so you created something that I think is very interesting, particularly for directors, which is a Board Training Institute of Japan. And when we met back in 2013, you'd already had started that maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years before I met you. But I thought it was really interesting. You took on a personal kind of like mission to do this. And why don't you tell us why you started it, how did it evolve, where are you today? I think that's a great story because you are informed about how directors are trained or think about their jobs.
Well, I guess the story of my life is I sort of reinvent myself every 10 or 15 years just because I get, half the reason is frankly, and this is almost embarrassing, I get kind of bored doing the last thing, or I feel like I've succeeded as much as I can doing the last thing, and I want to do something new that strikes my fancy. But in this case, it's a combination of that, but more importantly, the fact that I had sat on, at that point, 3 boards, and I could see all of their dysfunctionalities in Technicolor. And they're very common, you know. And the more you sit on Japanese boards, the more you realize that they're more similar than they are different. They are most different when you have, you know, a founding family and somebody, a large investor in place, as opposed to a very, very diffuse share ownership structure. So there's a big difference there. But there's a lot, the dysfunctionalities are often quite similar even then, just sort of a matter of degree. And I learned from sitting on the Alps Mapping Board, and then after that, Live Door Holdings Board, to clean it up after the scandal. That was basically the Enron of Japan that had imploded, and 9 months later, a bunch of hedge funds and other investors asked me to sit on the board as an independent director. I realized that the biggest problem we have here is that, hell, you know, Nick, you've been yapping about changing largely the law, the corporate law, and requiring independent directors and this sort of thing, committees and that sort of thing, and to some extent, board practices for years. But, you know, we can change all this structural stuff and the law, and we can add in independent directors on a nominal basis. But the other half of the equation is the human capital part. Mm-hmm. If as you say in Japan, if directors don't have the spirit of the Buddha, you know, you have to put the spirit of the Buddha in the Buddha, or it's just a block of stone. They have an expression in Japan which kind of speaks that way. And this is quite true. You know, directors have to know what their role is and understand what this governance stuff is all about. And it's good for the company and for society. And it's a societal role. And they have to have a little bit of passion and devotion and dedication to that. And and frankly, you know, be willing to give up the job and be fired if you can't do the right thing. And if you don't have some semblance of that kind of philosophy, and you don't try to increase it and improve that sense of dedication to ethics more, and understanding of key topics like you know, common skill sets. This is another area I'm diverging a bit, but one of the things that's most dysfunctional Japanese boards is that you don't have people with the common raw basic skill sets that they need. Knowledge of corporate law, knowledge of securities law, knowledge of finance, reading financial statements, and board practices, accepted best practices. People don't have common knowledge about those topics. So you got one guy, instead of that, you have one guy's head of product development, another guy's head of sales, another guy's head of administration, and they know their two areas in their vertical silos well, but they don't overlap very much in the areas where you need board skills and be able to read the financials together and question each other about the strategy and the financials properly. So without that knowledge and without the right philosophy and ethical sort of mindset, we don't have a board. We just have a group of managers in different vertical silos that's not able, capable of doing oversight, looking in a long-term future for the company. And I realized that that was really missing, that I could jabber and jabber and write all these articles, which I did for years and years, and you know, public proposals and American Chamber viewpoints, that kind of stuff. And we made some progress with that, but it wouldn't really make that much progress in improving Japan long-term if we didn't address the human capital side. And so I like having a mission. I'm a sort of a passionate guy about what I do every day. And if I don't feel some excitement about the job, that's when I get bored and want to do something else. And I did make it my mission. And what I did was I made the mission even harder by trying to get what's called certification as a, quote, public interest nonprofit in Japan. You know, anybody can set up a nonprofit, but there's a certain kind of nonprofit in Japan, which is a public interest nonprofit, which is you have to be certified and go through this very difficult process and get accepted by the, in my case, the cabinet office, because we're a nonprofit for all in Japan. This takes a year and or more. It was about a year and a quarter for us. It was very difficult. They told me no three or four times, and I came back and said, you know, I'm not going away. You know, we fit all the criteria. You set up the criteria when you changed the law a couple years ago. If we fit the criteria, you have to accept us. And that's the way it works. Where normally, you know, when they tell you, when they encourage you to retract your application, most people humbly walk away in Japan because of the embarrassment of being turned down publicly. That never happened. But I just said, look, I don't care. Go ahead. I dare you to turn me down, basically.
And so how many director trainings have you done to this date?
Oh, gosh. Well, last year was about 300 and some directors that we trained. We have small... you know, really not
cohorts.
Not often more than 12 people per course. Often quite, you know, more like 9, 8. So it's a very small interactive sessions for, it's only one day because that's what the market can bear here. It can't bear much more. Very rarely will people pay for more than a day, but it's very intensive and it allows for a lot of interaction and discussion. And you know, sort of.
And is it focused for publicly listed firms, private firms, family firms? Do you have distinctions or?
Because we are a public interest nonprofit, our door has to be open to everybody. But that can include customized or semi-customized training for large corporations. We've done a number of them, or mid-sized corporations, any corporation wants to walk in the door. So the door has to be open basically to individuals or to corporations of any stripe.
And do directors need any certification to serve on boards in Japan?
No, nothing at all. It's just like the U.S. and other countries where essentially, you know, we're allowing airline pilots to fly jet aircraft for you on your trip to Hawaii on OJT.
They're
on job training.
So going into kind of the governance hot topics, in 2001, you wrote an article that was published by the Wall Street Journal where you talked about Japan's coming shareholder revolution. And at the time, 20 years ago, you talked that finally that there may be more accountability and oversight by outside independent directors. But why was that concept so resisted in Japan? And what is the current status of shareholder engagement now?
Well, the story of Japan's economic miracle and its fast growth was purported to be, and largely is, when it was successful, the story of METI and other bureaucracies in Japan sort of working with and working for large corporations to, you know, help select people who look like they're winners and give them more support, either indirectly through the bank or directly through subsidies and that sort of thing. And that myth, shall we say, that reality in the 1960s and 70s turned into a myth later on when the world changed, became more diverse, and Korea came back up, and there were other lower wage countries coming up the technological curve to compete with Japan. And it no longer would be possible for that system, which had been so successful in the 60s and 70s, to work anymore. And at that point, Japan's bureaucrats were, you know, not being perfect, had no, you know, nothing to put in the place of the prior bureaucrat sort of led or nudged structure sluicing capital in the right directions, nudging it in the right directions. And that's because in the meantime, one of the things they had created turned into a liability at that point, which is cross shareholdings. They had invented this incredible wall, this defensive wall of cross shareholdings in the early 1960s when Japan joined the OECD and had to liberalize its capital controls. Japan was very afraid of taking.
Is that the famous keiretsu?
Well, yeah, that's exactly it. Cross shareholdings are basically, what causes cadence to occur, is it? Because people in these various destinies all own stock in each other, which is cross shareholdings. And that was erected by at the instigation of METI in order to be a takeover defense in 1962 or so. They put together a stock buying corporation and invented the idea of cross shareholdings. And later on, that just turned to a natural function when everybody, convince them so they can get more business by holding stock in each other, say insurance companies, and then go on a one-way basis, buy stock to get more insurance contracts. And this all ballooned. At that point, therefore, having done that great defensive wall, that was fine. But end of 1990s, say, or early 1990s, this had to be rapidly, they should have done is rapidly destroy the wall, right? Maybe should have turned around and said, okay, now we're going to ban cross shareholdings because what we need is a free capital market where shareholders have to be stewards and oversight their companies they invest in and disinvest if they don't think they can rob proper returns or proxy vote, that kind of stuff. But they didn't do that. Mm-hmm. They just let it be as part of the Japan we love and we have to keep. And so this iron bowl of cooperation between the bureaucrats and the Keidanren, leading industrial Japan, kind of like the business roundtable, only sort of more powerful at that time, was very, very, very strong as an edifice in holding the, I'm going to mix metaphors here, but holding the floodwaters back of any change, whatever, in this very comfortable, cozy relationship of cross shareholdings and existing governance structures that we don't want to change. And since the industrial community had so much power with the bureaucrats, and the bureaucrats liked that and could keep power over the industrial community by, vice versa, being supported by them. So it's kind of mutually supported each other's power, shall we say. It was really impossible to do anything other than insert the idea of independent directors and get it discussed a bit, at which point Japan would end up inevitably doing absolutely nothing of, of marginal realistic progress for literally a year, for 15 years. Up until I proposed the corporate governance code, we made such marginal progress on a lot of areas here as to sort of disgust me. I mean, I made some progress in a few areas. I could brag about those later on, but nothing major. And so it was quite depressing.
Yeah, and it's interesting because then in 2010, you led a task force to commission economic analysis, and you wrote a white paper that was very influential and that led to the growth strategy and that was raising productivity by improving corporate governance, entrepreneurship, labor mobility, and that should be the central pillar for Japan to evolve. And over time, right, in Japan, the stewardship code was enacted in 2014, and then the corporate governance code in 2015. So maybe why don't you walk us through these two massive developments, maybe the effect of the white paper, and then what did they try to achieve with the stewardship code and then the corporate governance code?
Okay, so I'll try to give you a nutshell, but it's not easy. In 2009, I looked at Japan's growth policies. They didn't call it a growth strategy then. And was really, really disgusted that they were such hodgepodge mixtures of wish lists that came up through the Kaidan men and the industrial community that Mehdi had shuffled off to the cabinet office and called, you know, some policy for growth or economic policy, not even growth. And
maybe you should describe what Mehdi is for the for those who don't.
Well, Mehdi is the Ministry of the Economy, Trade, and Industry, and they had historically been the in the world of deregulation, the ministry that needs increasingly to find other jobs to do, and so they ended up being for the last 30 years or 40 years the most aggressive force for possible, or hope for possible change among the bureaucracy, because they were willing to go a little bit outside of their established boundaries, which were regulation of the manufacturing industries, which were rapidly deregulating. They needed other things to do. So that's the good news about Mehdi. And right, they're pretty, very smart people. And right now they've actually turned their 180 degrees as to their attitude towards corporate governance. I should say it's very productive. It's quite helpful. But at that point, they were not. They were very much in the mode of protecting the Kaidan men's interests, and while seeming to make marginal, grudging progress on issues that other people, including domestic investors or outside people like myself, would bring up, or the American Chamber, et cetera, make nominal. Look like you're making some perceptible progress. You're really not doing much, and you're satisficing your major constituent, the Kaidan men. So in 2009, I became very concerned about Japan's imploding. You know, we're walking towards this cliff of demographic shrink and aging of society and much lower PPID growth, a country's productivity, total factor productivity had been really wandering around 0.2%, 0.5% or negative compared to what it used to be, 10% or more. And the we raised, it wasn't really rocket science, but the Doyle white paper was literally 100 times more powerful than I thought it would ever be. We commissioned economic analysis from Kyoji Tsukao, a professor who was the leader of productivity economics at Hosotsubashi and in Japan, probably the preeminent person who knows about economic productivity analysis. And we got 100 pages of analysis out of him. And based on that, we wrote a white paper on a number of different topics, not only corporate governance, but that was one of the main ones, but also entrepreneurship, labor mobility, women in the workforce, this kind of thing, tax policies, a whole stream of things that should be done. And it was all wrapped up in a nice, if I say so myself, very convincing wrapper, which summarized the obvious that, you know, Japan, you're headed for this cliff and you need growth, or our debt will overcome our ability to service it as our national debt. Because it's bloating constantly. And so the only way to get out of this tunnel is through productivity enhancement, productivity increases. There's only three ways to improve GDP. You increase population, you increase capital infusion, or you increase productivity. And productivity is much more effective of the three. A 1% increase in productivity increases growth much more than 1% increase in capital. And you already have a lot of capital. By the way, the problem of that large capital gap is it's not productive enough. When you talk about productivity, you're really talking about profitability of companies. And so this was very widely read, this white paper, behind the scenes by all the bureaucracies, particularly Mehdi, who read it and said, Jesus, of course that's correct. And they probably already knew some of it that hadn't been espousing it. I mean, because this really wasn't rocket science. It was backed by very credible economic analysis that sort of proved the point. And so this injected the idea of productivity improvement as being a major goal in Japanese economic policy over the next few years. And that is why they basically adopted all of the major themes and growth strategy subtopics that were in our white paper in 2013 when Prime Minister Abe came into power and invented this term, Abenomics, and used the word a growth strategy for the first time in a meaningful sense. I.e. one which is based on analysis and the improvement of productivity. So the words like growth strategy and productivity became tied at the hip. And when the minute you start tying yourself to productivity, you tie yourself to two things in particular. because they don't cost tax money. Almost anything else you would do to increase growth would cost tax money. But governance and labor practices or labor law changes do not cost tax money. And so they became the most essential things. They already were in our white paper, but the government started espousing them. And once they started doing that, it was a short step from there that they had continued the Democratic Party of Japan's effort to amend the company law, which had this nice thing I could take advantage of where they would had a comply or explain provision in the company law requiring each company to have at least one outside director or explain why they do not. Mm-hmm. So that was very, very useful because it was the first time that I know of, and I think ever in Japanese law and in company law in particular, where they had a comply or explain type of principle articulated in the law. So I could then go to the lead diet man in charge of the growth strategy committee that they had started up. This is all because of the white paper advised them to do it. You got to start a committee and get political leadership under it and get the bureaucrats out of the room and look at your policies overall, not per ministry, not in silos. And they said they took all that advice. And so they had a committee set up and I went to the lead guy in charge of labor policy and governance and suggested that we have a governance code in Japan. And up till then, the idea of a corporate governance code had not been discussed very much at all in Japan. Every 3 or 4 years, somebody would come up with the idea, but it never, never gained any momentum. This time it did, because he was one of the leaders of the committee, really number three in the administration, and he took action. He asked FSA to his office, and then he asked the Financial Services Agency, like SEC, and then Tokyo Stock Exchange in his office. And he convinced them, persuaded them using a lot of memos that I put together, because I'm kind of coaching in the background with all these the legal arguments and what a corporate governance code is and what kind of provisions should be in it. Convinced them to have a corporate governance code, whereupon it then became governance government policy in 2014. After I made a presentation to the LDP's Growth Strategy Committee, subcommittee in charge of these topics. So that was the next step, was to have me go public. This is not a private meeting, this is open to the press meeting of this subcommittee in charge of capital markets for the Growth Strategy Committee, where I made a presentation about why we need a corporate governance code. And the argument was that, well, you're thinking of having a stewardship code. That's a great idea. That idea was just getting started then. Thinking of having a stewardship code, but it's not going to be very functional and won't work very well if you don't have a corporate governance code that requires a lot of disclosure about the what practices companies are using inside the black box of their company. If stewards, investors don't know if you have a committee, you don't have a committee, who's the head, who's the chair, not that you have how many independents you have, what your governance policies are, then they don't have a lot to engage about. So you can talk about engagement stewardship all you want, won't be very useful without the disclosure required by a governance code. So that argument was actually very successful. And in 2014, it was the concept of having a governance code was the lead pillar in the growth strategy for 2014, which is the first year they really put any meat in the growth strategy of the Govern Japan at all. And really the governance code was the pillar of the 2014 growth strategy. And it's really to this day, unfortunately, the major success of the structural reform arm of Abenomics. When you say Abenomics, what's Abenomics? Quantitative easing? Well, everybody's doing that in the world, right? And then it's fiscal policies for growth, which is to say we spend more money, more government money and subsidies. Well, everybody's doing that too. So the only part of Abenomics which is in any sense unique or new in Japan is structural reform. And the only part of structural reform, unfortunately, I have to say that they've done, is the governance leg. But they have done the governance leg, the stewardship code and the governance code, reasonably well, because they act, as I put in my initial memos, and it's often quoted, as two wheels of a cart. You know, the cart can't move without both wheels because they reinforce each other in a synergistic way. So that got them both started, and really that caused a huge, over the next 3-4 years, quickly caused a change to occur in the world of governance in Japan. No, in other words, the game was up. The Keidanren's fortress walls had been toppled, shall we say, and even the Keidanren had to get on the boat I'm mixing metaphors horribly here, of corporate governance and seem to be in favor of it where they had been totally resistant before. Things changed totally.
So how did, for example, board composition change?
Well, now we have, on average, on a TSC1, about one-third of directors are independent or claim to be independent by those companies. Our system, the Corporate Governance Code, allows each company to have its own definition of independence, that, however, based on the TSC's definition. And that's a big change. So one-third, and then you know, a considerable number of companies growing each year has 50% or more independent directors. And this, these kinds of numbers I'm giving now were unthinkable 6 years ago.
You know, certainly for board composition, I mean, that was unheard of even 7 years ago.
Well, now you have all this disclosure. That's really what the Corporate Governance Code is all about from my point of view. Once you have disclosure, people have something to throw darts at, criticize, or praise. And then the word engagement has some kind of relevance and has some effectiveness. And that virtuous cycle, as it were, is now underway. So things are not perfect in Japan, as they're not perfect in the United States. But the trajectory and the acceleration of that trajectory has changed drastically. And there's much more discussion and awareness of these issues now, and books in the bookstore about all these topics now, whether it's ROIC or ROE management, this kind of stuff. The world's changed a lot. Although, in the U.S., we also have changed as well.
And no, for sure. And it reminds me that in 2009, you wanted to publish an article on executive pay when the U.S. Approved the say on pay, and you said that advisory votes were not enough, and that didn't go anywhere. I mean, what was your thought back in 2009 with executive pay? And what do you think about the U.S. Evolution of disclosure to shareholders on executive pay?
Well, particularly in 2009, the U.S. and Japan were the antithesis of two systems, you know, the opposite of each other. I think in general, U.S. executive pay has been out of control for many years and continues to be even more out of control every year that goes by, despite all
I was reading today the numbers of the top 10. It's amazing.
If somebody told you in 2009 we'd be where we are now, would you believe them? Even in the U.S., you know?
Right.
So this is going on post the breaking of the U.S. bubble, the financial recession 2007. And, all those huge incomes that have been paid before that. And, U.S. is talking about say on pay. Well, say on pay, as you know, is an advisory vote. The board doesn't have to follow the vote. They don't agree with it. They don't have to. And so just getting momentum towards agreement around that concept of say on pay when it's just an advisory vote was a huge struggle in the U.S. And in Japan, we have a system under the corporate law where the aggregate total of director compensation, which includes executive compensation for the most part, or guides it, is subject to approval of shareholders, either as a overall quota that's, in your articles, or every year you get reapproval for the aggregate amount. Anyway, this shareholders have the right to say, no, we don't agree to that. We're only going to accept this amount. And that's in the corporate code, so we don't have that problem. Mm-hmm. And I was saying in this article that the U.S. should adopt a similar system and we should get around it. We just kill the debate by having shareholders agree that this makes sense, these numbers make sensible sense. But I couldn't get it printed anywhere because, as you can imagine, the Wall Street Journal, et cetera, who all these people I sent it to, five different places, don't think that's the kind of article that their U.S. reader executives want to read. And I finally sent it to Elizabeth Warren, who was head of the TARP Commission then, and she sent it around to all the congressmen who were in the committee, which I thought was hilarious because I got it right to the audience I wanted to get it to.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, at least in the U.S., what happened with say on pay is it did create a broader engagement at some level with institutional investors. Right. And that was, I think, a positive change. You know, talking about engagement, so in the last few years, we've seen a rise of ESG and stakeholder capitalism. I'm sure you're aware of every single initiative in this side, the Business Roundtable statement last year and the British Academy
and you've got all this idea of stakeholder capitalism. And I'm curious, what is the impact of ESG and how do you see ESG in Japan, maybe in comparison to the US or other international standards?
Well, there's a lot of similarities actually between the sort of recent faddishness in the United States and in Japan, because both are playing catch-up ball to Europe, which took on the ESG fad, I will frankly call it. And I mean this in a balanced way, much earlier than the other two. First of all, it's ESG in general. My general view of ESG is that it's a marvelous thing or concept in the ideal sense, in the idealized version of it. But right. In reality, it has a lot of problems. It is, to me, I analogize it to a baby who can't even walk yet, or maybe it's crawling. If that, it's very young and unrefined. It can't really analyze sustainability very well. It doesn't really know what its purposes in life are, but it's claiming it can save the world. And I just think that's that faddish sort of gaga version of it doesn't match with reality. I'm all in favor of it. I've talked about ESG for years here. It used to be back in 2009. I would mention ESG to people in investor training and director training courses we were getting started back then. And people didn't know what I was talking about. I had to explain what the letters meant and why this concept exists at all. It was that unknown. And even back in 2013 and 14, it was that unknown. So I've been a advocate of this. I just don't think the more I get into it and sit on boards, that it goes nearly enough, and that we need to change the incentives in the actual corporate structure in order for the goals of ESG to have any hope of being attained. And that's what we'll get onto that maybe later on in discussion when we talk about the blog post I put on blog forum. The problem in both countries, in all countries, is that ESG doesn't have proper incentives to back it. The institutions are asking managers who are not, as we just discussed, in their executive pay structures, evaluated on or paid later on based on long-term sustainability. Their pay isn't put in restricted stock that's vesting in 10 years. It's not that long. They don't have any incentive in executive pay structures to think long-term as much as they're being asked to do. Neither do the fund managers. Have you ever heard of a fund manager who's going to have to wait another 12 years for his bonus? That doesn't happen in the world of finance. And so there's a fundamental dissonance or divergence of reality from idealization here in terms of the incentives, which are the most important substructure of any kind of concept like this you'd like to push ahead. And that's true in both countries. The difference between the two countries, Japan and the U.S., is that the U.S. is kind of being sort of, I would say, sort of forced by public opinion and the realization that there is some link between sustainability and the stock price to move in that direction. And Japan's situation is a little bit different, because the greater part of the tendency to make this into a fad in Japan is that the GPIF touted it as its major, that's the National Pension Fund policy. And corporate Japan sort of jumped on that as an opportunity to have ESG, you know, bold capital E, bold capital S, small case, not bold, G. In other words, it was an excuse to not talk about G much, E and S a lot, and how good we are. Those, and they are very environmentally friendly in many cases. So the companies have something to brag about there. And so you can understand that kind of reaction. But investors, I have to say, have also taken the same attitude, because that's just easier to do in Japan's, given past its historical evolution of how it thought about governance going back 10, 15 years. And, you know, we're not sure yet. We're just getting into fine tuning our governance practices. And it's not clear in Japan, to most institutional investors in Japan, what governance practices will result in better governance. They're not convinced in all this governance stuff here. So we have some differences like that.
So talking about the small g, right? One of the big things that has happened in Silicon Valley, where I'm based, is a lot of these tech firms have, at least since 2004 with Google's IPO, adopted the dual-class share structures and kept control within individuals and typically the founders, saying, you know, we don't want to deal with, you know, institutional investors. We don't want to deal with activist investors for sure. And this has been not only a U.S. issue, and it's a very big U.S. issue, but it's also been a big issue internationally. And I'm wondering, what is the take from Japan? And, you know, there is a side topic from SoftBank, because that kind of hit in their face with WeWork and Uber when Masayoshi Son was involved there. And they pronounced recently that SoftBank Vision Fund portfolio companies would no longer tolerate dual class shares. But I'm just curious on your thoughts, being an expert in governance, you know, how do you think about these dual class share structures?
I dislike them vehemently. I think they make a mockery of the concept of shareholder democracy. And there's no insurance, whatever, that the people owning those super voting shares 5 years, 10 years from now, particularly if they're transferable, will be the right people to be entrusting control of the company to. I'll readily agree that there's an advantage, as we both know, in the governance world to having a large shareholder, a 20% holder, a 30% holder, who's got a lot at stake and sits at the board. And that's why a lot of family companies around the world, and particularly in Japan, outperform steadily on a statistical basis, firms where you have diffuse, dispersed shareholding structure. But there's a big difference between, and a lot of firms like that in Japan, where you have a 30%, 20% holder, and they outperform as a result, family company or not. However, there's a big difference between that and the super voting rights concept, where these three people really control the entire company. And those rights may be transferable in perpetuity. You know, it shouldn't be in perpetuity. At the very least, it should be limited number of years, and it should not be transferable.
So what is your position with sunset provisions?
You know, you're talking about the worst of two evils, the better of two evils. You know, I think that they shouldn't be allowed at all. In extreme case, you shouldn't be allowed to make a private company that way. I wouldn't go that so far as to say that. If you want to do that, the other shareholders should not be shareholders. They should be creditors.
Interesting. I like strong opinions, by the way.
Well, I mean, as you can see from the Harvard Business School blog, I just don't think the present corporate law structure has caught up with changes in the world and industry and economics and technology over the last 100 years. And that's just another.
Well, let's talk about your proposal. So recently you wrote an article in the Harvard Law School Forum on Corporate Governance called Redesigning Corporations, Incentives Matter. Let's go through your proposal and discuss it so that people can hear the merits of it.
Okay. I'm happy to. When I teach corporate governance director training classes or business school students, that kind of stuff, one of the first things I teach is about limited liability and what is a corporation. I teach them what is a corporation, because the most distinguishing feature of a corporation is limited liability. And I'm utterly amazed constantly at how few people understand this. And so what I've suggested is, obviously making the point that, you know, as a famous chancellor in Britain said 200 years ago, did you ever expect a corporation to have a conscience when it has no soul to be damned and no body to be kicked? Well, that's the basic problem, right? You can't put a corporation in jail and it doesn't have a predisposed incentive to act otherwise to avoid jail. This is our issue that we face. And so what I've come up with is something I've been thinking about for years now, frankly, that we need to redesign the corporation to reflect certain things. First of all, that limited liability is a privilege of immense value. And it doesn't really make sense to allow shareholders to escape all future risk by just selling the stock immediately. We may want to think about that more. And regulations liability coming down the road, and they're going to be stricter in the future. And that's really what the ESG movement is largely about, is that, you know, get you prepared, self-prepared, that in one day it may be prohibited to sell oil, for instance. You know, think about that in advance. What are you going to do in order to head that off of the gulch and shift the direction of the company in a different direction before that destroys its value? And we also need to think about the fact that we have much larger pools of capital available now to pay for the damages that result from externalized risk when something bad happens. So my structure, or the idea that I'm throwing out there in the debating environment so that people can kick it around and throw darts at it, hopefully, but my hope here is that we just widen the ESG debate to include things which it is avoiding, like a taboo now. It's, in other words, the debate is avoiding the potential upside or need to redesign the corporation as it was designed 150 years ago to something different. And so what I'm suggesting is that, look, when you start a company, when you issue more stock, when you trade stock on the stock exchange, we're going to charge 20 basis points from, you know, against the amount to be withheld from the amount of all purchases, sales, or issuances. And so that's just 20 basis points. It used to be stock commissions were something like 20 basis points to an individual investor. So it's not a huge amount. Mm-hmm. And that next, that every director or senior executive must invest 50% or more of his total comp each year that he receives as a director or senior executive in a special subordinated class of the company's stock, subordinate to the other holders. And he has to continue to hold that for 5 years after he leaves the company. So he's placed in a higher risk, higher return, because we can give him a lot of this stuff if we want, but it's higher risk situation than the other shareholders. And that the 20% or 20 basis points funds that they're taking him from his purchase of stock or receipt of stock, or and particularly from outside trades on the market or issuances, that'll all go into an externalization bankruptcy trust fund, or you might better call this a ESG dividend trust fund. Let's call it an ESG dividend trust fund. Mm-hmm. Because what will happen is that in 5 years, if the company doesn't go bankrupt, you're all going to get your money back, right? You will all get your 20 basis points back in proportion to the degree of time, the amount of time during which you owned the stock during those prior 5 years. So you own for the full 5 years, you're going to get, you know, all your money back, and so on and so forth. And if you had, you know, less, you may get less back. Now, if the company goes bankrupt, however, we're going to take this fund and we're going to use it to address the claims of claimants from, you know, the opioid crisis or the credit derivatives blow up or the flutamide problem or whatever it may be, you know, asbestos, et cetera, that resulted in the bankruptcy of the company. And so the company may go bankrupt. But then we will move aside, and instead of doing a settlement to lower damages with all the opioid crisis, we will have a fund to turn to make them happier than they would be otherwise. And my idea is that using these funds in proportion to the degree in which someone held the stock and therefore had the number of years in which he had time as an investor to affect its governance. And he had an incentive, therefore, because he would be subject to possibly losing his 20 basis points in 5 years if he didn't do proper proxy voting and engagement during that five-year period of time. If he invested in the stock for the full 5 years and had a lot of opportunity to do that, then he has the chance of losing all that money. If he owned it for only one day, then it would be less. But if it's only one day, then you get into high-frequency trading who could game the system by doing this in a lot of little stocks, so they never owned very much at all, and so they never lost very much at all, since it's diversified. So I think you should assume that anyone who owns a stock for a day, or even a high-frequency trade, should be paying it, and would be assumed to have held it for a year when we disperse the money and decide who has to, who gets returned more money than not. Well, you're going to be assumed to have held the stocks for a year, even if you only traded for a few seconds. And that way, what you would do is you would raise the incentive that investors and directors and executives all have to actually think and act very long term. And incentives would be better balanced than they are in what we have now, an upside tilted world, where it's upside tilted because everyone related to the company, and particularly directors' incentives, have options, this kind of stuff, and a fixed, you know, cash salary as a base. Whereas all of the folks that don't invest in companies suffer the downside, externalized risk with no upside. So all the opioid patients and all the asbestos patients and et cetera, credit derivatives after recession, all the people who went bankrupt as a result of that, and repercussive effects from that. They don't get any upside from all this stuff. It's just totally externalized risk on them because they aren't related to the company, even as a stakeholder. So stakeholder capitalism won't solve this problem. We have to get to the incentives to prevent the problems to occur in the first place. So that's my idea. That may be hard to understand. And it's not a tax. I think the better way to think about it is it's a ESG dividend. If the company continues to remain sustainable and doesn't go bankrupt after 5 years, you're going to get all that money back. And if it doesn't, to the extent it does not, we need it to address claims beyond the bankruptcy point. We will use until the pot is dry, at which point we as a society will be better off because we won't have all those unsatisfied externalized risks, i.e. the opioid crisis.
Yeah, I mean, what a, you know, I'll give you points for creativity, right? For bringing something different to the table. I mean, obviously, you know, I have some reactions to it and you know, we could do, you know, a full podcast on it. And one of my, you know, questions would be, well, interesting development is blockchain, right? And you did mention blockchain technology in order to track these shares. And I don't know how much you've got into, you know, blockchain or crypto, but one of the interesting ideas out here is redesigning incentives from a crypto structure. So instead of having shares, instead of having a corporation, you have a crypto structure where you give incentives to the token holders. And to me, that was really interesting, right? Because it's a little bit going at the same core issue that you have identified, which is, look, the system is not working, incentives are are all over the place. And doing it through like some crypto structure makes the incentives cleaner from different parties. And I thought that is rethinking, again, corporations that, you know, as you say, we've had since, you know, 400 years, and it's worked fairly well. And but now we're getting to a point where maybe we need to rethink this. And I don't know, how have you been able to look into any crypto structures? And, you know,
I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say that my take is, my experience with it is either people are engineers and very into cryptography, into the technology side, and don't understand corporate governance. And the people who do corporate governance just don't understand crypto or technology enough. And there's no communication between the two. And I feel this is an area that is very interesting.
True. I think that's quite true, what you say. And there should be much more discussion. I use the word blockchain stock in my mind for years, or when I've discussed this with a few people. I call it blockchain stock because the concept is to track the beneficial ownership of each and every share. As so that cell, as it were, that particular share is a blockchain based cryptocurrency by itself, as it were. Shares in paper don't exist. Shares in normal form don't exist anymore. And every single share is this blockchain type of stock, which is tracking which owners owned it when and for how long. So that later on, if the company goes bankrupt in so many years and we have to open up the pot and see, okay, how are we going to, how are we going to
recover?
Whose funds are we going to use first to pay off claimants? And whose funds are we going to use last to pay off claimants? Based on how long they owned the stock, because they had more chance to affect a change of governance and influence governance so that this didn't happen, the demise of the company did not occur. When we have to decide that, we can decide that based on how long they own the shares, and that'll all be incorporated in the blockchain. Now, but it doesn't, to me, you know, I'm not a technical guy, although I'm helping with technical stuff as we do data collection at BDTI. I'm not glued to the concept of this being blockchain or any other particular technology. I just think in today's world that the engineers can come up with lots of ways to track beneficial ownership. And right now what we have is a system, again, which is 60, 70, 80 years old, of custodian banks, where beneficial ownership, particularly for high frequency trading, is not being tracked at all.
Right.
In any way. And this is ridiculous in a big data world. It should be possible when a company goes bankrupt for at that time, and not until that time is my concept, to open up the door and take who has been running this company? Not just executives, not just the director on the board, but in behind the scenes, the asset owners and the fund managers that were involved in the governance could be the proxy advisors as well, but folks, asset owners and fund managers, particularly, who are involved in the governance decisions of voting and affecting change on the board, you know, who's responsible at the end of the day?
Right.
It's only possible if you track beneficial ownership. And so we need a technological means to do that. And I'm open to any ideas to do that. So, you know, I'm hereby on your podcast, waving my hand saying, technologists with a better idea than blockchain, please come up with it. But I know blockchain is slow. It has problems when you try to implement it in practice. I know that. But I'm just trying to, instigate more debate on the topic.
Nick, it's been a great conversation. Thank you again for coming on to this podcast to talk about your story and certainly your governance background in Japan and your proposal on redesigning incentives for corporations, which I think is a very good way to think about this. And again, it's been a great conversation.
Well, thanks very much, Evan. It's been a pleasure to see you again. If I could, I would just put a yell out there for asset owners and fund managers and the like in the United States investing in Japan that you can always donate to the Board Director Training Institute of Japan. We are a government-certified nonprofit that is focused on improving governance through training and analysis of corporate governance practices and how they lead to better performance. Evan, thanks very much for all the great questions. You've caused me to think even more about topics which are fascinating.
Great. And just one last thing. How can these asset managers find you? Is there any public domain or social media or a place
where... website, just an email sent to info@BASINBOY.org.jp. You'll reach all sorts of people here.
Okay.
Great.
All right, Nick. Thank you very much. And we'll talk soon.
You're quite welcome. Stay in touch.
Okay. Bye.
Bye now.
Thank you for tuning in to this Boardroom Governance podcast. If you like this show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast with colleagues or friends. You can also subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com.